Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
How's everybody feeling? Relaxed?
Yes.
Okay, then my job's done.
No.
Okay, so we're all here to learn a bit about meditation. I think meditation is a great thing. I think it's one of the best things anybody can learn. Something that they can incorporate in their lives. I think if you do get the hang of it, you get used to it, you get the benefits from it. Is one of the most beautiful things you can ever do. And you know what makes it so beautiful is it's just this simple idea of having a mind which is free from all the mess that's in there to begin with. It's sort of like, you know, meditation is sort of like the weekly rubbish collection. You come here on a Tuesday, and I'm making this up. You're coming here on a Tuesday night, and you collected all the rubbish in your head for the whole week, and now it's time to empty it. And who cleans it up? The monks do. Okay, so meditation, the art of calming the mind down and making it peaceful, and eventually that leads to, you know, a sense of well-being and a sense of happiness. And that's all, you know, a lot of us want that in our lives, is to feel good about ourselves, you know, to wake up in the morning and have a good morning, you know. It reminds me of one of the teachings the Buddha taught, and it was about people, you know, living happily, or people being good, or people making good karma. And he said that, you know, people who give or who are generous in the morning are happy in the morning time. And then there's people who give and who are generous, who are, you know, caring, and if they do that in the afternoon, they get happiness in the afternoon. And so too in the evening, you know, if you're good-hearted, you're giving and caring, you get happiness in the evening. So, you know, this goes to show that if we wanted to, we can create this happiness that we're looking for throughout our day. And it's all a lot of it has to do with the training of this mind. And part of the training of the mind is to try to develop the wholesome states of mind. And a way to do that is through the meditation practice. And what meditation does is it allows us to just separate ourselves from the world, so that we can have this time to see what is actually going on in our minds, right? Because when we're busy with our families, or when we're busy with whatever we're doing, our mind is occupied with something else. And when do we actually get that time to actually see what's going on? And the time that you can actually see what's going on in your mind is through this meditation practice, and through the practice of just sitting down quietly in a quiet place where there's nothing happening, you know, your eyes are closed, you're sitting comfortably. That's when you start to see what is going on. And it's sort of like whatever happens during your day plays back in your mind when you're meditating. I'm pretty sure that happens, you know, just before you go to sleep, you sort of replay what happens during your day. And whatever happens during your day, whether, you know, you may get into, you may say something to somebody and it may be negative, you know, how does that feel when you're just by yourself, alone, looking at your mind? It doesn't make you feel that good, does it? And a lot of people, I think they come here because of some sort of stresses in their lives, and they've seen that, you know, and they come here and they want to know what can we actually do about it. So what you can actually do about it is to actually see what the problem is to begin with. So you see that, okay, you know, I have this kind of problem in my mind, and you know, what can I do about it? And you know, the Buddha talked about developing wholesome states of mind, you know, thoughts of gratitude, just being positive, bringing out those good feelings. And I think it's something that one has to try to generate within one's own mind. You know what a good feeling is. You know what happens when you care for other people. You know what happens when you're positive, when you're feeling good about yourself. You know what that feels like, right? And meditation, a part of it, the trick of it is to just try to regenerate that feeling or that perception in your mind. And that's the thing, you know, this meditation practice is sort of like trial and error. It's an experiment. You have to actually go and do it to actually know whether it's beneficial or not. And then you see, you know, you see how it works. And if it's, you know, if it's working for you, then it's something that, you should continue doing and continue pursuing. Because it does eventually bring you a sense of peace and a sense of happiness. And, you know, living, you know, the you know, being a monk for a long time, like, you know, take Ajahn Brahm, for example, who's been a monk for 40 years, and you know, living a very simple life, you know, in the forest, spending many hours alone, and just developing the mind, training the mind to be quiet, you know. So you, when you're sitting there, you know, you direct your mind to quietness. And he's been doing that for 40 years. Imagine what kind of effect that would have on your mind. And then for 40 years he's been, you know, there's a practice in the monastery where you know, you just reflect on your goodness and, you know, the good things that you've done. And then just imagine doing that for 40 years. Just sitting down and just reflecting on the good things you've done, how you positively affected other people in your lives. If you did that for 40 years, how would you feel and how would you be after that amount of time? Your whole person, you know, changes. You become somebody completely different. Somebody who is, you know, put simply, more happier, more content, more easygoing, more relaxed. And that's basically, I think, one of the main goals of this path of practice, is to get to that place where you can actually feel at ease with yourself. I mean, it sounds really simple, and it's, you know, it's nothing complicated, but for us human beings, it's a hard place to get to be honest. And, you know, from what I understand and how I've been practicing, it's something that you just do day in, day out. You know, you never give up. You put your mind to it. You create that positivity. You create that stillness. And the thing is, when you have a positive mind, when you have a, you know, mind which is calm, which is lighthearted, it's a lot easier for you to meditate. You know, it's a lot easier for you to tell your mind to be quiet. And what do you guys want to meditate on for the guided meditation? Breath meditation?
Yep.
So yeah, okay, I'll talk a bit about breath meditation. So breath meditation basically is a technique where you use your mind and focus on one object. And, you know, because the breath is quite a simple object, and it's quite easy to find, when you sit down, you sort of just focus on it or trying to watch it. And the whole idea is what happens in your meditation practice is that you'll start to see your mind moving about, or your mind may be tired or whatever's going on. I don't know what's going on. And so the breath is there, and what that does is just allows your mind to anchor itself, in the moment. So right here, right now. And right here, right now, there's you're not thinking about the past, so you're not thinking about the future. Making plans. So the whole idea of this meditation is to be in the moment, to be in the now. And people want to get like a sense of relaxation, a sense of freedom, and the way to get it is to be in the moment as much as possible. So the breath is there to help you anchor your mind in this moment. So when your mind wanders, when it's thinking about, what is it thinking about? Oh, it's thinking about the t-shirts that you might want to buy at the end of the at the end of this session. They should have some brown ones, eh? Some brown ones.
It's got the brown colour print on. It's the same.
No,
nice.
brown, so monks can wear it.
Yeah.
That's the best way of advertising it.
Yeah.
If we wear it and just walk around the city, people will want to buy it.
Yeah,
you got extra large?
Yeah.
Just like your brum size, not mine. Well, anyway, so the breath is a great tool that you can use because it's quite simple. It's there, but there's always a word of caution when you do this type of meditation. Is try not to be too willful when you do this. Be as gentle as possible and allow yourself to make mistakes. You can never get, well, you can get the perfect meditation, but a lot of times you can never get the perfect meditation because the mind is just not right. Right? So when you're meditating and your mind is wandering, you put it back onto the breath and it doesn't stay there. Doesn't matter. You're allowed to make mistakes. Just tell yourself that. You're allowed to not be the perfect meditator. And always have like a gentle, a very kind, very soft attitude, because what that does is it develops a positive relationship to the meditation practice. And that's why people come back. That's why Rachel's been here for 30 years. But Doug has been here for 30 years. That's why people come back, because they have a positive relationship with the meditation practice. And if you can do that, that keeps you on track. And giving it patience, giving it time over the years, over the decades, you're going to get something from it. If you don't, you can have your money back. So, yeah, I'll stop there. And, you all know how to meditate by now. You just need a few words of encouragement. So we can get ready to have a sit. Yeah? So just get yourself into a comfortable position. And just take a couple of deep breaths to be able to bring your mind into this moment. A place where freedom lives, or a place where true happiness lives, is right in this moment. So allow yourself this time for some quietness. Now you don't have any responsibilities. It is time for you to just let go of everything for the next half an hour. So remember, there's no pressure on you to you know, get the perfect meditation. So first of all, we'll bring our awareness, bring our minds into this body. So we can start off by feeling the sensations in our feet. Just allow your feet to feel the texture of the carpet. All this does is it helps center the mind in this moment. Away, if your mind is centered in this moment, it's, you know, you can see it right now, it's separated from all the troubles and all the worries that you have in life. So just allow your awareness to run up your legs. Yeah, how does the calf muscle feel, or how does the shin feel? What does that area feel like at this time? And just run your awareness up to your knees. And then run your awareness up your legs into your bum. And just feel how your bum is touching the seat. There's the pressure that's there. So just linger there for a little while. Put your mind there. And then run your awareness up your spine, around your stomach, up into the chest area. Around your shoulders. And just run the awareness, you know, down your arms and to your fingertips. And then from there, just take the awareness up your neck and around your head. And now just allow your mind to develop the present moment awareness. You know, just to be here in this moment. You can be aware of anything in this moment. You can be aware of the sounds, if you can hear any. You can be aware of the sensations in your body. A good question to ask when you meditate is, where am I? And how do I feel? Asking yourself, where am I? I think is a good thing because as somebody who's meditating, you understand that you're supposed to be in this moment. And sometimes when you ask yourself, where am I? You could be thinking about your holiday that you're planning, or thinking about what you did a couple of days ago. And that question is a good question because it sort of brings the awareness of what is actually happening in your meditation practice. As meditators, sometimes we can just drift off and we don't even know that we're drifting off. We're just like in la-la land. So that question, you know, where am I? It's a good question to ask because it does bring you back to this moment. So now you can move your attention to your breath. And all you're doing is just watching the in and out breath. Watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out. And remember just to have like a gentleness to your approach of watching the breath. So if your mind wanders, just gently bring the attention back to your breath. You know, when you're meditating, there is supposed to be like a sense of ease and a, you know, sense of relaxation, you know, a sense of calm. So, you know, try to experience that when you meditate. Try to bring your attention back to your breath whenever the mind starts to wander. But if your mind, wandering mind is, you can't stop your mind from wandering, then there's no need to watch the breath. But sometimes the wandering mind is just too strong, and watching the breath, you know, it's not really working. So instead, just allow it to be, you know. A lot of monks teach that here. Just allow things to be. If your mind wants to wander, let it wander. If your mind wants to go to sleep, let it go to sleep. So whatever the mind wants to do, just be kind to it and allow it to be. So then the meditation is coming to an end. So this is a time to just analyze what has happened over the last half an hour in the guided meditation. And this is where you learn about your mind, you know. Learn about what it's like. And then you can, you know, after analyzing, you can understand what your mind also needs to be able to, you know, calm it down and to make it peaceful. So this part of the meditation, I think, is quite important, is to be able to just spend a few moments to just reflect and to analyze about what has happened. And through that you learn about what what antidotes to apply to improve and better your meditation practice. Wake up. Does anybody have any questions about the meditation? Oh, no? I'll just give you time to think. Maybe you can come up with a question afterwards. So does anybody have any questions?
Here's a question. Is it better to meditate before you eat or after you eat?
Before you eat or after you eat? It's best to meditate as much as possible. You can meditate before you eat, and you can meditate after you eat. Yeah, it just really depends. Sometimes, yeah, it just really depends. You know, I don't think it's a big deal whether you meditate before you eat, or you meditate afterwards. Like for example, in the monastery, monks have a really big meal for lunch because they don't get to eat during the day. So not all monks, but most monks. That's a little secret. Most monks have a big meal, and if you try to meditate after a big meal, then you just end up going to sleep because your body is just using up all the energy to digest the food. And so, you know, when you meditate on an empty stomach, that could be useful because you don't have anything that's really making you tired. But if you're really hungry, then you might just start thinking about food, which is not necessarily a bad thing. So, you know, you just got to work it out for yourself whether you need something to eat or not. Okay. So, it's time to give a Dhamma talk,
mm-hmm.
I guess. I was just thinking of a trip that I made to Thailand, and that was a couple of months ago, and I met a monk, and I went to three or four different monasteries. And I stayed with Ajahn Dunn, who is he's a famous monastery in Thailand. He's been to Perth once to the monastery to give a few teachings, and also caught up with Ajahn Sumedho. If all of you know Ajahn Sumedho, who ordained many years ago, at the moment he's living with Ajahn Yana, in Ratanawan. And he's getting quite old and he's quite sickly, but he's still doing his best to, you know, help and teach people. But so I went there, but next to Ajahn Yana's monastery there's a monastery and the abbot name is Ajahn Gunha. Yeah. And he is like the original happy monk. That's what they call him. And I just want to just like to relay this story because it's like an example of somebody doing something which is inspiring, and from that, you know, as humans we can learn from it. And when we went there for one night, and we got there at around about 3 o'clock, and Ajahn Gunha, he was in Bangkok, and he had to go see a supporter because the supporter was in hospital and she was like really sick. So he Ajahn Gunha is known for his generosity and his kindness and his loving kindness. So because this was one of his long term supporters, he went there to see them, and he basically spent the whole day with this person. So I was there with Ajahn Kemavaro and a group of lay people from Sydney. So we went to the area where Ajahn Gunha receives guests, but you know, he wasn't there. So then we asked the monks who were around, you know, where is he, what is he doing, and they told us what was going on, and they showed us to our rooms because we were going to stay there for one night. And then they said, come out at 7 o'clock. That's the time when Ajahn Gunha is he comes out and he receives guests at the time. And you know, he's one of these monks where he gives a lot of time to lay people, you know, the reputation is that busloads of people come and see him every day to, you know, get a few teachings, to give a blessing and whatnot. So he's a very busy monk, and he's always, you know, he's always giving, always helping out the lay community. And I think at the moment he's building he's helping the Queen, I think, the Queen of Thailand, to build a hospital, or princess or something, to build a hospital, for people in need. So we were asked to come back at 7 o'clock, and to see him, but he wasn't there. He was still at the hospital, or he was on his way back, and his monks were there, and they welcomed us, and they made us cups of cocoa, and gave us a few sweets, and there were lay people there as well, and they made the lay guests from Sydney cups of cocoa. And then it was 7 o'clock, and we were waiting, and then it was 7:30, he still wasn't there, and then it was 8 o'clock, he wasn't there, and then we were thinking, you know, should we stay here, or should we go? And during this time, they just kept on bringing us cups of cocoa. So after one cup of cocoa, and then the second cup, and then it was like 8:30, and then he still wasn't there. So then we decided to wait until 9 o'clock. We just wait until 9 o'clock, and then if he's not there, then we'll just retire for the night. And then the monks were still very kind. Instead of bringing us cocoa, they knew that we had enough, so they bought us water. And then instead of bringing cocoa to the lay people, they bought them water as well. And then eventually he came in at 9 o'clock. So it was 9 o'clock. And we're thinking, oh, maybe he's not going to see us. You know, he's been out all day. You know, he must be very tired. But you can imagine, a famous monk like this. You know, he's just gone back. And, you know, usually they'll just be tired. They just go back to their rooms and rest. And then wake up the next day and continue with their daily routine. So when he came back at nine, you know, he sat down in his chair. And then, you know, they bring him drinks, and they, you know, they, in Thailand, you know, if you're like a very senior monk, just out of respect, the junior monks would like wash your feet. So, you know, the junior monks come along and they wash his feet, and they give him like a wet towel to wipe his face. And then one of the monks told him that there are people from Sydney, and monks as well, coming here to visit you, Thanajan, for one night. And, you know, without hesitation, he instead of retiring for the night, he went to the area where he received the guests to receive us. So you know, he was there, you know, after a really long day, and this was 9 o'clock, and he was just going through his thing. And he's going through his thing, and one of the things that he does is quite funny, is that he has like a bowl of sweets beside him, and then lay people are just sitting like close like this, and he'll pick up sweets, you know, by the handful, and he'll start throwing it at the lay people. And then, you know, they start catching it, and they start laughing, and, you know, they're having a really good time. And then after he runs out of sweets, he'll pick up cartons of like juices, you know, like, you know, 500ml juices, and then he'll start throwing that as well. So he starts throwing that, you know, creating a lot of, you know, laughter, creating a lot of joy, and whatnot. And people like that, you know. It just, he makes it like his happiness and his metta is so genuine that people come back for more. And that's why he's always busy. People are always visiting him. So that's what he does. He sort of like gets you in the right mood. You know, throws the sweets out, throws the drinks out, and then he gives you a blessing. And what he does with the blessing is he's got this like really long bamboo pole, like a really long bamboo pole, and then the lay people will just get down on their haunches, and he'll chant, and he'll start tapping people on the head with his bamboo pole, and, you know, in that way they sort of get a blessing, and, you know, that makes it feel good. And then once he gets them like in the mind, the right frame of mind, you know, when they're happy, when they're open, that's when he starts teaching them. He gives them the Dhamma. But so that's what he did. That's what he did on that night. He got everybody in a good mood, and then he started to give a Dhamma talk. And you know what impressed me the most was that he gave up his time. You know, it was nine. He came back at 9 o'clock, and he spent 1.5 hours. With the lay people and with the monks, just giving his time, helping out, you know, wherever he could, with instruction, by inspiring people, and you know, after being there and just witnessing that, I thought that was quite inspiring, just to be able to see how, you know, a monk of great respect is able to give up his time to help other people, and you know, those are the examples, you know, that we see and hear about in our everyday lives that inspire us to, you know, be better people, you know, people that we can, you know, emulate, and yeah, so. Yeah.
He doesn't throw pizzas, does he?
No, he doesn't throw pizzas. I was trying to think of. No, anyway. So yeah. So just having a bit of inspiration in our lives, the examples that we have around us, whether it's our mother, you know, our kids or whatever, you know, just helping us to be better people, and. And yeah, it's just, you know, there's some. I was living in Wat Buddha Dhamma, and it's just like another story of how you know, people just show their kindness, and in Wat Buddha Dhamma, we don't have electricity in our kuti, so we don't have gas. So we have to chop wood. We have to chop wood to light up a fireplace to keep us warm. And our kutis are very small. And when Ajahn Appi was there many years ago, he got these stoves which were fabricated from like a welder. So it's like this small stove, and it's like a tiny opening. And so when you chop up the wood, you just chop it up in like little pieces, you know, little pieces. So in the wintertime it does get cold, and Wat Buddha Dhamma say every once in a while you have to go to the wood chopping area and you have to chop your wood. So you're like, we chop it up. And I live right on, like, quite up high. It's not on the mountain, but it's like on the, just like where the cliff is, you know. So I had to walk up there, and it's quite steep. And from time to time I would prepare some wood. I would chop it up and put it into a shopping bag, and I'll just leave it down at the Sangha house. The Sangha house is a place where the monks get together, like in the evening, have tea and stuff like that. And so I would leave it there, and I would go off and have my meal. And by the time I get back, my wood has disappeared. I thought somebody had stolen it. I thought somebody had stolen, huh? So then I go, oh, okay. So then I walked to my hut, and when I got there, outside of my room was the bag of wood. You know, somebody has brought it up there for me.
Did you have bad thoughts when you see it missing?
I was like, I think so, yeah. Like, who's all my wood? Like, where's my wood gone? And then, yeah, so then. And then, you know, somebody brought it up for me, and I thought, oh yeah, that was sweet. Yeah, that's really nice. And you see things like this happening in the monastery, and it's quite inspiring. And there's this one, you know, when a pastor broke his neck. You know, he fell over.
He was here last week.
And he broke his neck.
He's so funny.
And he was out for like 3 months. But when he first broke it, you know, people were worried about him to the point where there was this monk that slept outside his kuti for a couple of nights on the walking path, you know, without, I don't know what he was sleeping with, but just out in the open, just to make sure that Upasama was okay. Yeah. So these, you know, these things that happen, you know, these things that happen, you know, in the monastery or in our lives are quite inspiring, and hopefully they can inspire us to do good as well. Yeah, just to go out of our way to help people. And you know, the reason why they do it is because it makes them feel good. It makes them feel, you know, appreciated. So you know, when this monk, he brought the wood up to my kuti, and I knew it was him because he was, there's only it was him and other monks, but I asked him, so he said he brought it up there for me. I said, oh, thank you very much, you're a great monk. And then when I said that, obviously it made him happy or whatever, appreciated. So then the next time when I chopped wood and left it out in the Sangha house, I went out for my meal. And then when they came back, the wood wasn't there. And I was wondering, who stole my wood? And as soon as I got back to my hut, outside my hut, there was that pile of wood. So then it sort of got to the point where I think, taking advantage of the situation. You know, monks aren't perfect, but sometimes it happens. I was thinking to myself, if I chop wood and leave it out there, then he'll take it up. Then I have to take it up myself. But then the funny thing, when you start thinking like that, is, you know, you're being selfish, right? In a way, sort of like using people. And then when they don't take that wood up, and sometimes you didn't take that wood up, you would get really upset and angry. So after a while, you just forget about it, you know, whether he takes it up or not, it doesn't matter. If he does take it up, you say thank you. If he doesn't, that doesn't matter, you can take it up yourself.
And if he did two bags?
Huh? Did I do two bags?
If he did two bags. One for him,
one for you. Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, any comments or questions?
What was the Dharma talk that you got in Thailand? You just told us that he threw lollies and then said he gave a Dharma talk.
Oh, the... It was basically about giving. Yeah, it's just like give. And what I understand, by the way, he runs his monastery is that it's sort of like, well, he's got a lot of monasteries. There's places where you can go and spend time in seclusion, and but his main monastery where he lives is a place where people make a lot of good karma, and so there's always something going on. Like, you know, you work in the kitchen. I think someone told me when they were there, they were planting trees for the wild animals, because, you know, I think you know, all of it was like, you know, depleting, so they wanted to regenerate the forest. And I think when he was there, the elephants were looking for water. There was drought in Thailand, so he decided to build a couple of dams, you know, around the area. So he gets the people that lives there to, you know, just to give up, you know, their you know, what they want to do, and you know, and to just be able to just serve the community. And he said that's a big part of the practice, is to, you know, let go of what you think the practice is about, let go of how you think people should practice, and just give and see how far that takes you. So it was a lot about giving. He spoke about that a lot, yeah. And I can't really remember much. And also about, you know the defilements and letting them go and how much suffering they cause. You know, the usual stuff that you hear from monks. Yeah.
To me, if the monks learn Thai, because it seems to be that a lot of monks go to Thailand.
Yeah, some of them do learn Thai. Yeah, some of them do learn Thai. Or the other thing is, there's a lot of Western-speaking monks living there as well. So you can find places where there are a lot of Western monks, like Wat Nanachat. And yeah, you basically, like, if you're there for the first time, that's one of the places where you go to, where there's a lot of foreigners there. You learn, they speak English, and from that point, you learn how to speak Thai. And then once your Thai is good, then you can go to other places. Yeah.
You get a lot of Western people there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of Western people there. Yeah, the Wat Pa Phong tradition is still very strong, and a lot of people are interested in going there to practice. Yeah.
I suppose, like yourself, then, if you want to go, you just turn up, do you?
Yeah, you gotta make a few phone calls and just let them know that you're showing up.
And step off the bus with your little thing.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the places is, if you show up, you spend 3 hours travelling there, it's quite strict, and you show up without invitation, then they'll ask you to leave.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Even dressed like that? And
I don't know about dressed like this, but not for lay people.
Yeah.
For monk, maybe they make exceptions, but I'm not too sure. It just really depends on the monastery. Because you get all different types of people go through, and you get different types of monks as well. And then from experience, they learn how to create a system to allow people to come in or not. Some places are a lot stricter, some places aren't. Yeah.
Why does a monk travel to different monasteries in particular? Is there
what are the purposes? It's maybe there's a few reasons why they go. Sometimes it's a teacher that they're interested.
Mm-hmm.
Say some of the monks in Bodhinyana Monastery are interested in, you know, the Thai Ajahns, and maybe one day they want to go there to just check it out and practice. There's some of them they've done their, like, one of the things as a monk is you're asked and encouraged to stay in a monastery for the first 5 years. So as a junior, you stay in the monastery, you learn the ropes, and once you mature, then you're so to speak allowed to go and travel around, and there's many different monasteries around the world that people like to go to. Sri Lanka is quite a popular place, and Thailand is as well. Yeah,
mainly warm countries, isn't it?
Thailand's a bit too warm, don't you? Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
Why did you become a monk?
Oh, this question. You know that the answer changes every time. That's kind of weird. When you look back, you look at different things and it changes. Or you just want to keep it quiet and not let people know the truth, the whole story, but only parts of it. So I'll give you a part of the story. Why did I become a monk? I was 23 at the time. I was very young, and I didn't really have much going on at that time in my life. I was doing my apprenticeship to become a chef, but I never finished it. I got bored of working in that industry, and things happened in my life, and troubles arose, and I wanted to figure out how I can overcome them. And for some reason, I don't know why, but my mind got drawn to the meditation practice, basically. Like, I tell people that before I went to Bodhinyana Monastery, I didn't even know who Ajahn Brahm was. I just wanted a place to practice, pretty much. Because I knew, like, I was practicing as a lay person, and just understanding that lay life is cluttered, as the Buddha would say, with things to do. And I was trying to practice, but I always get distracted, with my friends or whatever's going on. So I wanted a more serious environment, a more strict environment. So I decided to go to a monastery. But then, so when I first came into the monastery, I had in my mind that I'm going to go to a really strict place, got to keep the 8 precepts. It's going to be really difficult. So the first time I saw Ajahn Brahm, he was going around. We were like lay people downstairs. We don't go downstairs. They go around and they collect the food. And I saw this monk, and he was like joking around. Basically cracking jokes, and I thought to myself, oh, thank goodness, you know, this is a place where I can actually relax and have a good time. So that, you know, that was a relief, because I thought that coming into like a monastic lifestyle is going to be really strict. You got to act in a certain way, you got to be in a certain way. So that's the main reason, really. Is to find a place where I can meditate, and also I for some reason I wanted to become a monk as well, because I knew if I became a monk that would give me the time to meditate. So when I left home and went to the monastery, I told myself, you know, just give it a year or so and then see what happens, and then you know, just living there for a couple of months, getting introduced to, you know, Ajahn Brahm and his teachings, and just listening to his talks on we used to have tape players back then, the good old days, MP3 players, and just listening to his talks and understanding his way of meditating, and, you know, that got me more interested and that got me more into it. And since that, you know, first couple of years, I developed a strong liking for the meditation practice, and that basically kept me there ever since. Yeah.
So you were doing your chefing in Perth,
were you? Yeah, I was doing chefing, yeah. Cooking up pizzas and pastas and chocolate cake and all that good stuff, you know. Comfort food. You need a bit of comfort food every now and again.
Why does your name come from? You know, when you become a monk, they give you a name.
You choose your own name.
Is there a big book of names you can pick from?
You choose your own name. In Bodhinyana Monastery, Ajahn Brahm allows the candidates who want to become monks to choose their own name. So, what is it? So, yeah. So, whatever name you think you can aspire to. So, I chose Santuti, and it means contentment. Yeah, so I chose that. So it's something for me to aspire to. Yeah.
What does your name mean?
Kassapa. Kassapa was the name of the previous Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's a big aspiration.
By the time of this Buddha, it was a very common names, it's like a Martin or something. But in the suttas, in the teachings, there's lots of Kassapas. The master here, ascetic brothers for Kassapas. And one of the Buddha's main disciples, the ascetic that wore rag robes and lived in the foot of a tree, he was Mahakassapa.
But I think the name that one of the monks thinks is pretty cool is Ekavihari. Which I think it means like one pointedness, because as a monk we're trying to get to a state of one pointedness in our meditation.
Alright,
there you go.
Enough. So they're basically Thai.
Oh no, they're Pali words. Ancient, yeah. What is it? Yeah, ancient Buddhist language, Pali.